Memory of Water from Ryopi's 2023 album Thrive. In this episode of the Tune Your Mind podcast, we explore the more spiritual aspects of meditation, ancient healing wisdom, and look forward to the new Be Love album, which drops in January 2026, an album forged from the experiences discussed with our two interviewees. A little later, we'll hear from a 10th generation shaman, Mugenda Mikala from Central Africa, a man who Ryopi credits with saving his life and helped him rediscover his voice. Literally. But we'll start this episode with Professor Marjorie Woollacott, an American neuroscientist, author and academic, noted for her exploration of meditation and consciousness and its connections with neuroscience. And we'll experience previews of Ryopi's music, including two of the new album tracks, over the course of the episode. Of course, none of the information discussed over the next 45 minutes constitutes medical advice, and you should consult a qualified healthcare professional to discuss any health concerns, diagnosis or treatment.
Marjorie Woollacott, I'm absolutely delighted to have you on this podcast. There is so much I want to talk about and I wouldn't even know where to start. So of course I've been doing my homework and everything and I was like, actually, I just wanted to go like from the heart because I thought maybe it's the best way to really try to get inside your brain. What really, really matters, the outside layers, if that makes any sense.
I mean, when you say the heart, it's an interesting thing because I do believe that when I had my first meditative awakening many, many years ago now, what really happened was for the first time as a scientist, I became aware of my heart. And obviously, it wasn't that physical organ that pumps blood through my body, but it was like suddenly I became aware of the center of energy that was filled with love. And that then began like radiating this energy out through my body and beyond. And there was a sense that I had, in fact, of words that came to my mind, which are, I'm home, my heart is my home. And it was like that meditative awakening shifted everything inside of me. Now, it didn't happen all instantaneously, but little by little, after that meditative awakening, I suddenly saw that I'm much more than the physical body. I'm much more than my thoughts and my mind. I'm really interconnected with everything in the world.
This is incredible. I had something similar with the love. You feel your heart fully. So you are a scientist. Your resume is the size of a full book. So how can you mix you being a prominent scientist and at the same time a meditator and you are aware, as you just said, of your heart? How did that work?
The first thing to know is that truly, before that awakening, I was a materialist neuroscientist. I didn't really have a sense that there was anything beyond our physical body, our brain, the physical world around us, because that's how we are trained in graduate school in neuroscience. Of course, it's your brain that creates consciousness. And like many neuroscientists during my graduate career and early research, always thinking that those people that were spiritually oriented, that believed there was something more, were simply weak-minded until that moment when I had this meditative awakening and a meditation retreat. And I decided to put my skepticism aside for the weekend and just be curious about what would happen. And I think that curiosity was a key. Because then when he came around, he touched me between the eyes on the bridge of the nose. And I felt what felt like an electric current going from his fingers down inside of me, down to the center of my chest. And then I began feeling this love I was talking about just radiating through me. And all I can say is like, this is not what I knew as a neuroscientist before this moment. And then I should say it was simply gradually, little by little, that I began to learn to incorporate my scientific understanding of the brain and the body and the world with this broader understanding that we are all interconnected and that we have an origin that is pure consciousness, that is infinite awareness that we're a part of at our essence. And it doesn't mean that the world doesn't exist. It is a magical reality, I would say. I mean, it's basically consciousness within every aspect of the world. And so I simply had to take many, many years to begin to assimilate that inside of me so that I could hold these two worldviews as one rather than as separate.
I think it's okay to be skeptical because it is so magical, as you just said. To understand that and to live it, one has to experience it. Could you like detail how it started? You know, what kind of meditation? Because people sometimes, they're scared. Oh, I can't meditate because it will take me such a long time and I will never get there.
This is a tradition. It's called Siddha Yoga, S-I-D-D-H-A Yoga. And Swami Muktananda was the particular master that brought it to the West starting in the early 1970s. And what I would say about this particular tradition is that Shaktipat is the word that is often used for this particular awakening from the master to the student. And the word simply means the descent of power, in effect, Shakti, the descent of grace in a certain sense from the infinite awareness through the master into the student. And I think that all of these meditation masters from whatever tradition, if they are truly aware, they understand that they are only the conduit of this energy. They are simply trying to make themselves empty so that this energy can come through them. I should say, it doesn't mean that you have to find the right master to have a meditative awakening, because it's the grace of the absolute that is coming into you. And it can happen in some people, for example, when they are simply sitting quietly in nature, and they can have an awakening. And some of them are through near-death experiences. Some of them are through, for example, just waking up in the morning after some amazing experience in the middle of the night when you weren't aware outerly, but you were having an amazing inner awakening. Some people have their awakening through some sort of a psychoactive substance. I had it through meditation. What a person has to understand is that's only the first step. And then it takes days, months, years of progressively assimilating that into your own worldview and letting go of your limiting beliefs about yourself and the world and allowing more expansive beliefs to take over. It is a journey, and it is about the process. It's about the experience in each moment. And if I can just enjoy each meditation and not think, why am I not there, whatever there might be yet? In the moment, I am there when I'm in total presence of mind, total stillness in my heart.
So what kind of advice would you tell people to start if they wanted to start and being definitely enlightened by, you know, your words?
There are many, many different paths toward the self, toward the heart. And each person has to find the path that works for them. I certainly don't believe in one path. It can be from any tradition. It can be from many, many different teachers. But you find someone and a tradition that resonates with you. And then you listen wholeheartedly to the teachings of that tradition on how to turn inside to quiet your mind. It's the stilling of the thought waves of the mind so that we're totally present in the moment. And then we rest in who we really are. And if I can just have that behind my thoughts, because my thoughts are the things that get in my way. There are so many other practices that we use to assimilate this knowledge. And one is that we know that negative thoughts cause real problems. They cause us to be depressed, anxious. They cause a lot of suffering. And so the first thing we work on is how to let go of our negative thoughts and replace them with positive thoughts. And for me, often that is, how do I let go of my sense of disconnection and smallness and embrace the fact that I am connected with everyone around me. I'm connected with the plants around me. I'm connected with the red rocks in Sedona around me. And when I shift and let go of the negative thoughts and really home in on that feeling of connection, most of my suffering goes away.
When you said you go quieter, you mean in terms of brain waves? Can we measure that? Because there is so much, you know, data. As you know, I do, you know, a lot of binaural beats because it's very efficient. But I'm finding that you've got opposite studies as well. So it's very complicated to try and find what the truth is. So I use my right brain mostly because my left is not as great. And honestly, I find that like when you go 4 and 2 hertz, I find, you know, that this really go down. But it's not only the binaural beats. For me, music is magic, right? It's always been magic.
I was talking to someone who was also using a binaural beat technology with people, in fact, that were from the armed forces to try to let go of their PTSD that they've had from the trauma in the armed forces. And he said that he would actually see, because he had, again, EEGs on their heads, that they were going down toward more delta frequencies without being asleep. So they were aware, but they weren't asleep, even though delta is considered to be the level of sleep. We typically are in our normal thinking mode in beta, then we move down toward alpha, a more relaxed, and then down to theta, which seems to be more typical of many people's meditations. And then we hear about these Buddhist monks that seem to have the gamma frequencies that are filled with a sense of compassion toward others. And I don't understand that particular paradox, how some people may go into this gamma mode. And maybe it will take many years for us to understand that. I think we still don't understand exactly what is going on with that awareness in all the different parts of our brain. Perhaps the gamma frequencies are happening in one part of the brain where more alpha and theta are happening in another part of the brain, because our brain is not just one unified structure. I suppose I allow those paradoxes to simply rest comfortably with me, and knowing that people who are careful researchers have found both things, and it may relate also to the person. It may be that with that training of a Buddhist monk in compassion meditation for years upon years, they have a finer control of their brainwaves than some of the rest of us do. What you're reminding me about, too, is I'm thinking now about the stories we've heard about Beethoven, for example, and Mozart, for example, that felt that they were not creating their music, that something was going through them, and they were then allowing that, again, through their brain and their hands, et cetera, writing the notes down, hearing the notes inside, they were coming up with something that was absolutely phenomenal, that a human brain couldn't create by itself. And so I then ask, what is going on? Is it perhaps a combination of quieting the mind first, but then for those composers and perhaps like yourself, being in this flow state where they're out of the way, the egoic network is turned completely down, and now they're able to really let something from the spaces of consciousness that are all available to us, full of creativity, come through them into this body-mind complex and create the music?
I always felt that. And it's funny you said that, because for me, I always felt, as long as I keep my integrity and my heart and, you know, the right things, the music will flow. If I stop that, the connection will stop. And I really feel that it is this spiritual connection. With my upbringing, it was a bit tough, but the only thing that I was like, okay, for me, God, it's about being love, compassionate, kind, all times. That's it. Be this, be love. That's why I'm calling this new album Be Love, because that's, I think, the only way to save the world today is to be love.
Being a musician myself, I realized that when I had trouble being in the flow, it was usually because of this sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system-like trade-off that we have in our body, where, just to remind people about, we have this autonomic nervous system that has two useful modes. One is the parasympathetic mode, with the vagal nerve actually controlling that, which is about feeling safe and calm and open. And then the sympathetic mode is the one that we get to be in when we're anxious, when we're afraid, when we have fears about certain things like danger. And I realized when I was a young musician, I had to be careful when I was going into a symphony concert that I didn't allow my nervousness to take over, because for me, the sympathetic nervous system basically causes our muscles to contract. And therefore, it's very hard to play in a state of flow. Your mind is contracted, your muscles are contracted. And so it's beautiful to realize that meditation and other tools that we have can help the parasympathetic nervous system begin to take over and help us understand we are safe, everything is fine, we can be open, and then consciousness from that universal space can flow through us in the way it should, so that we can create beautiful music.
That's Ryopi's New York from his 2018 debut album. Now, back to the conversation with Dr. Woollacott.
So do you think the sympathetic nervous system, when you're in like deep levels of stress and anxiety, you mentioned the vagus nerve, because I was very sick last year and I saw my vagus nerve in a meditation and I didn't know it was the vagus nerve. I saw this thing red all over me. And then from that, I understood it was actually the start was the gut and it wouldn't connect fully to the vagus nerve. So do you think the stress and all of this can cause people to have issues? And do you think the vagus nerve can be a way to actually have this communication?
Absolutely. I think that that is one of the things that more and more people are understanding today, is that partly because we have created in our society a life that is relatively stressful because we have what I would say is a misunderstanding about what causes happiness and fulfillment in the world. We think happiness and fulfillment are caused by getting enough toys, for example, material possessions, getting enough accolades by other, how many papers have I written? How many times have people congratulated me on something? We think that that is what causes happiness. And in fact, that doesn't, because then we're always searching for one more paper, one more possession, one more this, one more trip, one more that, instead of saying, right now, everything is fine. And can I simply stay in the present moment and realize that my reason for coming into this world is for experience? It's not for accumulation of anything. It's not for outcomes. It is for experience. And as soon as I even say that right now, I feel a relaxation. I'm just here with you for a beautiful experience in the moment, nothing else. And then everything's okay.
You know, people have asked me a few years ago, I got number one Billboard classical, in the US, and people asked, oh, well, how do you feel? And I was like, I don't want to attach to it. I was grateful, thank you, but that's it. Because otherwise, where do you go from there? And that's why it's funny. I always say, like, the winners are the losers and the losers are the winners. Because the more money, the more problems, the more fame, you know, all of this. And people, everybody right now is trying to have money. It's sad. It should be about, as you just said, experience. And there is no fear when you are in the present moment. The fear is in the future or in the past. It's very difficult. So if we had like a little magic wand, what would you do?
That is such an interesting question, because I think that the issue for me too is when I came into this world as a little kid, I loved the world. I first should say something that I'm this learning right now. You know, we talk about the experience of awe. And in fact, the experience of awe is what I had in that moment of meditation when I suddenly felt connected with my heart and I felt connected with everything around me. And that experience of awe when you're a little kid is, in fact, I think the equivalent of everything is fine. I don't have to worry about anything. I know that I'm connected with the world. And then what happens is after you're about 4 or 5 and you get into school and you begin worrying about grades and about what other people think about you and having a career, you begin to create this egoic narrative around you of who you are, that it makes you separate from the world. And then you have a harder and harder time actually staying in the present moment and just feeling the joy of the present. And I think what I'm saying is that it's a natural part of growing up in a typical culture like ours. And what seems to have to happen is that at some point, maybe it's late adolescence or early adulthood, we need to begin to understand that the egoic framework is great. It's gotten us a career. It's helped us learn music or whatever. And now we have to begin to dismantle that so that we can get back into communication with everything else around us, this interconnection and this love, and find that balance. And in fact, I just want to mention something I find interesting about the older Indian philosophies, where they actually divided life into different segments. And the youngest part was what they called the Brahmacharya part, where you're a student and you're learning. And then there's the householder phase, where now you have a career for a while and you create a family. But then there is the forest dweller stage, where you can finally let go and go back into that place of not having to worry now, and now having enough money, enough things, so that you can now stay in that experience of the moment. And actually, the final stages are what they call the renunciate stage, where now you can simply say, I know I'm in this transition to moving to the other side. I can truly let go of all my obligations and just rest truly in my state of expansion. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that part of developing as a human being has these different phases to life, but can we stay connected through all those phases? Can I teach children in school that they are also infinitely connected to everything else so that they don't begin to feel contracted and small and competitive?
Yeah, it's not sustainable for anyone. And again, you think you win, but actually you lose more, because if you don't attach to things, you're happier. I fully agree with you. And for the kids, it's very, very tough. Yeah, it should be collaboration. And I say that to my kids because you already feel it at school. It's all about competition. Competition is not good for the brain. With your research, did you see that in the brains as well, in the physiology or neurological stuff it does to people?
I haven't done work myself on competition, but I think what we do know is that when you are in collaboration, you tend to have the positive emotions really dominant, which are, of course, the happiness, the joy, the contentment, the feelings of awe. And you feel a part of a greater self, which is, of course, your true nature. And so I think competition makes you feel small and separate, and thinking that there are limited resources and I have to have them for myself. So it's like the whole competitive worldview is one that's more materially oriented, versus this feeling of connection is one that is really what I would call consciousness is fundamental. And we need to know that. And then it allows us to let go of the anxiety that plagues our world today.
When I was 15 years old, I started humming a lot and singing a lot. And something happened. Some bad people made fun of me and it traumatized me. I never sang again. And it was fine. My piano, you know, my music, that's fine. But last year, I needed to sing. And I realized it does feel good in the body. And I felt like it was, yeah, kind of activating stuff inside. I have a tuning fork. I was actually even humming in 432 hertz, and I was humming in 216. And in 216, when I sit down, I felt the vibration down the root chakra up to the crown, like everything really vibrating. And I realized that I couldn't even sing before anyway, because my body was, you know, that was a problem.
Yes, and definitely I should say that there is a fair amount of research now on the fact that it is very, very good to actually sing in order to really affect the body and the heart specifically, as you're talking about right now. And they're showing that people that have heart rate variability that is not optimal, when they do even a single bout of singing for a certain number of minutes, can change their heart rate variability to a more appropriate rate. So I think that that is something that you actually found yourself when you were doing this. So it's very, very true that there's something about that affecting the vagus nerve and then changing the whole physiology of the heart and the other parts of the body, because the vagus nerve is connected, you know, to the lungs, to the heart, to the vocal cords, pharynx, larynx, et cetera, and the gut as well. So I think that those are wonderful things that we can do in a very natural way that doesn't take medication to actually bring our body back into alignment and make us then, of course, let go of the physical suffering, because we've let go of the mental suffering through the humming, through the singing. So it's a great, great therapy.
Well, Professor Marjorie Woollacott, I thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I want to ask you a last thing. What would you say to people, you know, just listen to this, not including, you know, neuroscience or whatever, but from your heart, what would you say to people to, for whatever reason, lead a better life, health, whatever it is, what would you say?
I think it's to truly find ways to stay in touch with your heart. And I think that the ways that we can think about it are, for example, those experiences of awe that are out in nature. That's a wonderful way. We know that we connect also through art and music. And it's also quieting the mind, staying in the present moment. That's hard even for me to do. And each morning when I come out of meditation, I say, now, as I walk across the room to the kitchen, can I stay in the present moment and enjoy the experience? Can I enjoy the experience of cutting the strawberries? Can I simply feel connected in that way? And then my suffering goes away, my anxiety goes away, and I'm connected to the heart.
The first of two tracks you'll hear today from the new Be Love album from Ryopi. That's Law of One. So we head from the US to Central Africa for our second interviewee, and a fascinating conversation between JP Riopi and Mugenda Mikala.
Why did I want to get this shaman from Central Africa on the podcast is because literally he saved my life. It was a bit tricky for me because I was like, do I talk about it? Do I not talk about it? But then, as usual, as everything I do in my life, it needs to come from the heart. I can't try and intellectualize it because it never works for me. Everything I try to control doesn't work. When I let go, it works. So I contacted Mugenda to know if he would be up, you know, for this podcast, and he said yes. So I'm very, very excited. Mugenda literally saved my life. I know it sounds crazy, and it is crazy, and still for me it is crazy, yes, but it is the truth. So that's why I wanted to have you on the show. So hi, Mugenda.
Hey, JP, how are you?
Well, I'm very good. Thank you so much.
You're a blessing, man.
I'd like you to basically talk about where you're from and what happened. Because as I said to you, remember when I had the name of my album, Be Love, and then I met you, and then you told me...
I told you it's going to be a holiday every day for you.
I'd like to put things in context again. You're a shaman. You're a 10th generation shaman. So from Gabon. So you were taught from 5 years old or something?
Definitely. Yeah, we study life itself. It's a traditional spiritual part, the art of knowing. Some people think it's a cult, it's a religion. No, it's far away from a religion. That's all with your booty. I mean, actually, it was like a way of elders back in the day. They will gather themselves around the fire to teach kids to share life experience, because actually back in the day, there was no knowledge whatsoever. Nobody knew about anything. It was just randomly thinking about anything, trying to make sense of life. Nobody knew about anything. That was before human find what we have now. I mean, like books, writing, and mathematics, every other things that we have now. So that means this goes way back, where it was all in the middle of nowhere in the jungle, because that's where life started. And that was before human find Iboga medicine. So even here in Africa, our people used to live on beliefs, on imaginations, you know. So some things making sense, people would just grab it and follow it. As time passed by, elders, again, sharing their life experiences, they were the one talking about pretty much everything and using the imaginations and things that made sense to them. This went on and on, not just for a couple of weeks, a month, or years. It went for centuries.
And for me, it's even more relevant to talk about it because I did grow up in a cult. I did grow up with a guru. And then when I met you, I'm like, no, you're not a guru, because you told me, look, I'm not like you guys in the West, all this new age BS, you know, trying to put a belief into you. You will experience it yourself. You will see the truth.
Yeah, JP. See, one of the first things that I'm enjoying nowadays and being happy about it is to see you standing and talking about your experience. Because I can remember when you came to Gabon, you were broken, like pretty much dying. And seeing you right now smiling, being this handsome guy, talking about your own experience, that's the reward to us. That's how people are helping. You're like, no, this is, the guy is so broken. It's like, I'm like, guys, let's just ask the medicine. If the medicine says we're going to help him, we will help him. If the medicine says we cannot, we have to tell him the truth. He has to go back. That's really amazing to see you share this with the world, because this is not a medicine that I went and buy. It's been in my lineage for centuries, like for generations. Maybe in a 10th generation, it's not a little title that I got from any schools out there. No, this is what my family been doing. It's just spiritual. You in the West have wrong ideas about spiritual. Do you think you have it? And I will say this to people who wants to hear it. Like the West, you guys have technology. Technology, you get that, you master it, and you're good at it. But spiritual, you don't have it. Spiritual, you don't write, you don't read, you go through your own experience. And when we're talking about own personal experiences, it's not about imagination. Sorry, buddy. No. It's not about you, the way you feel. See, spiritual, it goes past your feelings, past your own damn imaginations. When your mind's still working, your mind's still thinking, you're still here in the physical.
But now science is catching up, because now in the West, everybody is talking about Ibogaine. You went to the US to go and heal people in the US. And that's how Iboga became kind of mainstream, right? I mean, at least was talked about.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the US traveling, Mexico, Canada, everywhere. to Spain, the teachings of medicine. And actually, I had a big center, called the Iboga House back then in Costa Rica. I spent a lot of time in Costa Rica. So I've been traveling a lot to spread Iboga medicine and its teachings. If you want to heal any spiritual situations, you got to go on the spiritual ways. If you want to heal any physical problems, now you can go physical. That's the way it goes, not the other way around. And that's how you see anyone having mental problems in the West, they don't get healed because you folks focusing on the physical. Let's say someone has been depressed. Okay, this is current, as you know. The whole world is freaking depressed, man.
It's horrible, but it's true. It's true, yeah.
Now, what I don't understand, GP, is like the West, you have the best doctors ever. You have the best scientists, team research, like you're searching for everything. What's going on with people's like mental problems there? Everything is about the book. Anything not by the book, it's fake. It's not real. See, that's how you guys got everything organized there to really diverse people, to have people confused. And nowadays, look at that. Everybody kind of looking the way back now to the ancient time, because a lot of people waking up, which is a good thing.
As you know, for me, music saved my life, and you know what I do with music. And I wanted you to share, because of course, I experienced the music as well of Bwiti, you know, while doing the ceremonies for Iboga. And if you could share your history and experience and everything, you know, with the music and the spiritual, because clearly, for me, they've always been linked. And it's amazing to see that for you as well. And it's been like this for thousands of years.
Look at yourself and me, all of everybody. We're not from here. We look at music, we're not from here. Before we became physical, we were invisible. Same, look at the music. Until you will get to your piano, or someone has to get their own instrument, music is not there. So someone has to bring thoughts together, bring the body together to create something, and that's come out. It depends now how someone playing the music. There's what we call a physical music and spiritual music. Physical music, it's like random music. Someone can just, you know, play music for fun, whatever they do. But there's people like yourself who will transcend, like they will actually leave this world to go and get the music. And anybody listening to that music will connect with it. Who's going to be moved by this music? That's what we call in our tradition, the spiritual music. Like you will see the Mongongo music and the Hop music. Those are the first music that have been played by human. See the way it is? Who knows that? Nobody. Now someone has to connect to the music in a very high spiritual level. When someone like yourself connects in a very high spiritual level, you go to the invisible world, which is the original world. So musician, it depends on musicians. You know, when you look at them, when you look at yourself, look at the way you grew up. You grew up in a cult. You survived there. And I bet you nobody taught you how to do that music. You taught yourself how to do that music until you professional that. Nobody can understand. Nobody will or they could understand the way you did it. This is what I call a magic. The real magic, so that means you go back to the invisible time and world to bring what's for you in order to actually bring that to the physical world here. And that's all it takes. But it's not just for everybody. But everybody can do it. But where the world has been, where everybody gets messed up, that's the block. Each one of us, we have the personal gifts. It's up to us to bring our own gifts and explore them. People instead of exploring their own gifts, they become jealous to others. We just said that earlier. You don't want to have followers because you don't want people to follow you because you're not a maniac. You're not a control freak guy. You know what I mean? So that's so simple. So we don't need them. We don't need those to do those things. We human, we still be together and enjoying life together, sharing whatever we have. Like you do, like you're sharing music with everybody. I'm sharing my medicine with everybody. You know, that's how it's supposed to be. Now we're not trying to step on someone's toe. No. So music depends of the musicians, actually. Look at yourself, like I said. You know, you came from a cult that was just punishing you. Because he had this fire burning inside of you. And you were using the invisible power without even knowing that first. Until, look where you are. Anybody who can listen to your music will be drawn to it, will connect with it.
For me, music there's the soul. And basically, when I go to Africa, when I went to see you in the whole village, when there was the ceremony and stuff, everybody moves, everybody dances, everybody sings. And I'm like, wow, it is incredible.
It connects every living thing. It is incredible, very.
Everybody's calm as well. I was very impressed. Everybody's calm, like there is a harmony. And then, as you say, in the West, we know everything, we're the best, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, you know, it snows and everybody's depressed. So that's why, you know, the connection with music, I'm like, there is definitely something there. Right? So, Mugunda, if there was one thing you would say to the world right now, the people listening to it, which most of the people would be from the West.
But this episode, now imagine you are lost in the jungle, but you have no idea you're lost. That's going to be a shame. Do you meet up with a hungry tiger? He become a prey, a food to that guy. This is the 21st century going to 2026. A wake-up call, it's been already there. This world, it's God's world. It's not a human world like one person should be controlling everybody on this planet. Every single human being should be enjoying their lives to its full potential. So this is a time where any human can stop and think for a minute for themselves. Just to drop all the beliefs, all the so-called knowledge that they think they have. You know, it's been written in our essence to think and to notice what, when something was wrong or when we're following a wrong thought that teaches us somewhere. It's a time for any human to stop for a minute, like, where I'm going? Am I right? Am I right? Am I happy? Am I in peace? Am I really happy? Am I enjoying my life? See, truth, you cannot deny it, JP. No matter how much imaginations, how much beliefs, how much pretending that someone's doing, nobody cannot deny it, the truth, because we all know it. You know why? Because we are truth. It's right there in front of you. That's it.
Mugenda Mikela. And the final words go to Riopi.
When you feel you're dying, it changes everything, everything. And you really let go. And when I was in that state, I actually started singing. And the last time I sang, I was 15 years old. I was just going to the piano and it would start like naturally singing again. And my intellect was like, don't even think about it. And my heart would just sing, you know. And it's funny because one of the doctors, one of the therapists I saw, she told me, your vagus nerve needs to be activated. And I was like, oh, well, I'm singing at the moment. You know, I was like, oh, I'm singing. And she's like, well, because singing is very good to activate the vagus nerve. I thought, oh. Because, you know, my vagus nerve was down, my mitochondria, all the ATP levels, everything. It was like really, really, really crazy. So I started singing and I couldn't stop. And I would do even my kids. And then I started singing the songs and stuff. And when I was like, no, I'm not doing it, then the kids would be like singing the chorus, whatever. Like, oh, well. So I would just go to the piano and every time I would go, I would sing those notes. And again, my intellect, no, and my heart, just do it. So then one day I just, you know, sent a little video to owners. I was like, yeah, there you go. And I was like, oh, I really like it. Like, are you thinking? I'm like, well, in any case, those pieces are very beautiful piano solo as well. So we, and they were very good actually, because they didn't put any pressure on me. It's just like, yeah, whatever you want. And I really felt like doing it. It was like, my heart was like, do it, no fear. And as I was in a state, you know, of like really letting go, because you have nothing, you know, if you don't have health, there is no life, there is nothing, right? I mean, I started just like really not to care of what people would think, what people laugh, what people, and be like, I really don't care, because it makes me feel good to do it. It feels right to do it. So just do it and don't think about the consequences, because I'm not going to attach to the consequences. Whatever happened, happens, but I need to do this. So it's like a weird thing. 27 years later, I'm 40 years old and, you know, and I'm singing on this album and it does feel really good. And to be honest, I am not a singer. I see more my voice as an instrument accompanying my piano, because I'm a pianist. That's how I see it. It's funny, right? You go full circle. It's funny that at 40, I'm actually healing a very, very big trauma of my life. So you see, we carry on, you know, healing traumas.
Heard a whisper. At night she comes and talks to me.
bringing this podcast an episode full circle with Riopia's track Long Way Home, the pianist's very first use of his voice in his career, as he invites you further on this journey of self, healing and expression. There's more to come in 2026, from live performances to more enlightening conversations in the worlds of music, neuroscience and meditation. You can always find out more at the website riopy.com, R-I-O-P-Y.com. Thanks for listening.